I'm Alan Combs. I want to welcome to Heal Planet Serena Dyer. Serena Dyer, the name Dyer is very well known to those who are who follow higher consciousness and well-being. Dr. Wayne Dyer, of whom I was a tremendous fan and was very, very honored and happy to know, fortunate to know, passed away just a short time ago. And Serena, I know that you must have taken some comfort, I would think, from the outpouring of love that came from all over the globe after this sudden and heartbreaking experience.
I absolutely have, as has my family. I mean, when you lose somebody that you love, it's such a loss that you experience. But when people from all over the world, and I mean thousands of people, have reached out to say, he touched my life, he saved me from attempting suicide, he helped my marriage, he helped my mother heal from an illness, you know, he was who I turned to in time of need. There's actually no greater gift than feeling the love for somebody that you've lost, than feeling it on such a huge scale. I mean, I feel like it's an honor for us to have gotten to be his family and to receive this outpouring of love at a time, you know, rather difficult for us.
And he had quite a big family, right? You've had like six brothers and sisters.
Yeah, I have seven brothers and sisters. I'm one of eight.
Brothers and sisters.
So he had eight children.
I on a personal level, and I want to talk about your work and the way you've honored him with your book. But you know, he was always so generous. He would sometimes hop on the phone with me. I had lunch with him a couple of times. He was there for advice. I mean, I only knew him as someone who interviewed him a few times, and yet he was so giving to somebody like me who wasn't, you know. And actually through him, I got to meet Reed Tracy and had a book out through Hay House, which was the first time they ever did a political book. So I owe him a great deal, both personally and professionally.
Well, I can tell you that he was also a fan of yours. I remember when we spoke last year, it was a time when I was actually out there in Maui with him, and I was talking to him about that I was going to be talking to you, and he was saying to me, that's a huge honor, Serena. You need to take that very seriously. And, you know, he was definitely a fan of yours as well. And actually, politics was something that he had a secret passion about. He had a habit of watching the news every evening and yelling at the TV, which wouldn't be something you would expect coming from, like, a spiritual teacher, but it was probably his favorite hour of the day. He would get so fired up, and he would call all of his children, or if we were there, and he would, you know, talk to us about what was going on in the world and the type of things that we needed to do to counterbalance the trends that were happening, especially in America. And I have to tell you, he's very politically motivated. So, you know, your work was always of interest to him.
Well, I appreciate that. It means a great deal to me. But, you know, if you really read his books carefully as I did, I mean, I sat there and underlined and reread, and you could kind of tell what he stood for politically. His message of not judging people, his message of being open to people. He used to tell me I was on the side of the angels, except I think on taxation. He wasn't too fond of liberals on taxes. But other than that, I mean, you can tell by reading his work that this is not somebody who has 1 ounce of bigotry in him, who is open to new ideas, and in many ways just a very progressive mindset.
He was a very progressive mindset. He was in the Navy when he was 18, so that was 1958. When he was in the Navy, he had a friend who was an African-American man. His name was Rayford Douglas, and they became close friends, and my dad didn't view him as, you know, anything relating to the color of his skin. He viewed him as the type of man he was, the fact that they were both Navy men. They were in the same ranking and that kind of thing, and I remember a story he used to tell us was how they were at a lunch counter in the South when they were transitioning from one naval base. So they had done their training, and now they were moving to their naval base where they were going to get on a ship and they were going to deploy to Yokosuka, Japan. And I remember the story of how they sat at the lunch counter in their uniforms, and his friend Rayford was not served. They refused to serve him. And my dad said that the impact that had on him stuck with him for the rest of his life. The other naval men said, hey, sorry, man, and proceeded to order, and my dad and him left together. And my dad said that he picked up some sandwiches and they ate them outside on a park bench, and he talked to him, to his friend, about what that was like. And that impacted my dad for the rest of his life. So you're absolutely right. He didn't have an ounce of judgment towards anyone for anything. In fact, he was the type of person, and I sometimes speak of him still in present tense because I really feel him in present tense, as woo-woo as that is. He is the type of person that anytime there was a situation where a social injustice was taking place, it wasn't that he got outraged and furious and so upset over it, but he did to a degree, but that wasn't it. He got really compassionate, almost like he wanted to learn from the person that was experiencing it what it was really like to be them, to walk in their shoes. And I think he took that lesson and so many others like that that he experienced in his life with him throughout his life. And I think that's what made him such a great teacher, was that, you know, he really made an effort to try and relate to everybody or at least understand them.
We're talking with Serena Dyer, and she with Dr. Wayne Dyer co-wrote Don't Die With Your Music Still In You, My Experience Growing Up With Spiritual Parents, and both your mom, too, who worked with your dad on many projects earlier on. Did you always have a sense that your dad was different or special? Or at some point you must have, as a child, realized, wait a minute, he's not like other people in that he's famous, he's well known.
I didn't know the famous part until I was much older, simply because when I was young, so I was born in 1985, and he was well known when I was young, but nothing like now. I mean, now, you know, pretty much anywhere we would go, somebody would stop him and recognize him or his work. But when I was a kid, that happened maybe, you know, once or twice if we were at a place like Disney. That didn't happen every day. So as a young child, no, I didn't know he was famous, but I always knew he was different. I definitely had a sense that he was different from other dads, simply because I went to a religious school when I was a kid because it was a good school in the neighborhood. And, you know, my dad and my mom were the only parents that were saying things like, if that doesn't feel right to you, what that teacher is teaching in your religion class, then challenge it. Ask questions. Be curious. I would go home with a friend, and their parents would say, you know, your teacher is saying that you're asking too many questions in class. Just be quiet. Just keep your hand down. You know, it was the opposite of what I was hearing at home. And in so many other ways, too. I mean, my dad didn't wear a suit to work. He set his life up in a way that he was able to do the things that he loved, like swim and play tennis, while taking the time to also make sure he was writing every year, speaking, lecturing, traveling. So he had a really different approach toward things in life. And I can think of one very specific example. There was a restaurant in Maui where we used to go all the time, and we loved the food, but the waitress was just, you know, she just had a problem with everybody. If you wanted avocado on your salad, it was going to be $5 extra. If you wanted to sit outside, you couldn't, because you know, it was just always an issue with something. If I wanted to get something from the kids' meal and I was 12, she wanted proof I was 12. You know, it was that kind of thing. And my dad, rather than what a lot of people would do, which is say, well, you know, I'm not going to give her a tip, that'll show her, or we're not going to go to that restaurant anymore, I'm going to let the manager know it's because of the waitress. He said, you guys, this is going to be our challenge. We're going to turn her around. We're going to get her to love us. In fact, we're going to be her favorite customers. And every time we would go back, my dad would do something like ask her how her family was doing back in the Philippines, or compliment her on her hairdo, or talk to her about what was going on in her life. And eventually, let me tell you, the avocado was free on the salad. The dessert came out early. We didn't even pay for it. And truly, she became a friend of ours, and we became her favorite clients. And he did it through love, through compassion, through kindness. And most parents don't do that. And sometimes I think, you know, you can tell your children to be kind, to be compassionate, to be loving, but sometimes what you're doing is so loud they can't really hear what you're saying. And my dad did those things. He didn't just say them. He really lived them. He did them. He embodied them. And that was, you know, just the best thing growing up as a kid.
I know that to be true because, as I mentioned earlier, I had lunch with him a couple of times along with his longtime assistant, Amaya, and who worked with him for 30 years at least, and to whom he actually gave an apartment, a home in Florida. And the way he would treat a wait person or a staff person, and some people, you can judge so much about people by the way they treat those who they think are less than they are.
Right.
And your father always treated everybody like an equal, regardless of what station in life they might have been in.
But beyond that, you know, so a lot of times at a restaurant, you know, if you're having lunch with somebody, you're on display. So you're going to be a little extra nice to the waiter or waitress because whoever you're having lunch with is watching the way you treat somebody else. But my dad did this with the cleaning ladies at hotels. in a way that nobody ever saw. And that was something that I learned from him, that, you know, you can see somebody that's really making a point of trying to be very nice to the waitress, or, oh yeah, okay, sure, no problem, I don't mind waiting. You know, they put on like this happy voice, right, and they act like it doesn't bother them,
and you
when
can
you
tell
know
it's
it really
funny.
Does. But when it came to the cleaning lady in a hotel room, my dad would make such a point of leaving them a tip, leaving them a note, saying, thank you for cleaning my room, it's beautiful. And nobody ever saw that. So it's like he didn't just do it when he was on display. He did it in the private, quiet moments when nobody would have known, when nobody would have seen, and when nobody was watching.
Even in his book, though, he would acknowledge, you know, if I write a book, I'm actually helping employ people. There's the people who deliver the book. There's the people who make the paper for the book. There's he would go down a list of those who participate in the production of a book, so that it wasn't just, I wrote a book, I'm a famous author. Look at the people who also might, even without knowing, benefit, because it takes, this old saying, it takes a village, but it really does. And he certainly would acknowledge that, even in the kind of the fine print in his books, I would kind of see where he was giving that message.
Yeah, absolutely. Gratitude was his daily living, walking prayer. So it's no surprise to me that you picked up on it from a handful of meetings or phone calls. It's who he was. He was the embodiment of gratitude, as weird as that sounds.
Your book, Don't Die With Your Music Still In You, that is a phrase he would often say. And it's, I guess one could say, he did not die with his music still in him, correct?
I can absolutely say that. I think that he made a point of living life so, so loud, so fully. He embodied who he was in such a huge way that he changed the entire world. I mean, he really has left a legacy that is bigger than I knew it was. It's only in his passing that I've really seen from all over the world how big it is. So I don't think that he died with 1 ounce of a song unsung. I mean, I actually think it's quite ironic that the last 3 books he wrote, the one with me, which was important to him because he wanted to help parents understand how to raise their children to be spiritual adults. And that's what we worked on together with our book. Uh-huh. Then he wrote I Can See Clearly Now, which is his memoir of his life. And I have to tell you, I said to him last year when he was writing this book, Dad, I don't understand why you're writing your memoir at 74. Like, what are you going to do? Go and add an additional chapter, you know, a couple years down the road? Or are you going to make an addendum and, you know, add 50 more pages? Like, it just doesn't make sense to me that you're working on a memoir now. You're 74. You're going to have, like, at least 20 more years. I had this conversation with him, and he said, I feel called to do it, and you don't ignore that calling, Serena. This is the time I have to do it. If I have another 20 years, maybe I will write another memoir. And I was, you know, okay. And then the final book he wrote, which actually came out today, which was a compilation of stories from parents all over the world of their children who had memories. They were born with memories of heaven, and that's what it's called, Memories of Heaven. And that's his final book he wrote. He wrote it with his friend Dee. And it's just funny to me. It just gives me like a little smirk that book came out today, 6 weeks after he passed, because I think it's like his little way of saying, I wrote my memoir. I wrote my book about how to raise children in this way. And my final one is, hey, guys, here's some memories from heaven, because that's, you know, where I'm at now. So I don't think that he left anything undone. I don't think he left any page unwritten. I don't think he left any story untold. I think he came here and did his work. I wish he would have had more work to do, because I wish he was still here, but I understand it was his time to go. I really do.
I just think of all the lives he would still be touching for years to come, but his work lives on. And your book, Don't Die With Your Music Still In You, you certainly picked up on a phrase that resonates so well, especially right now.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that it's a really poignant line. Don't die with your music still in you is such a poignant line for me, at least, to remember. You know, he taught you to play the music you came here to play. He taught you to live your life fully. Do that.
How did you do that? How has that played out in your own life, that message of don't die? I mean, you're very young, but still, time is precious. Our lives are precious. We only have a certain, you know, the clock's ticking.
Yeah, and I think I'm still coming to terms with what all of that means. You know, I think for me, the way it plays out in my life now is that I kind of just go for it. So whether that means I'm a little bit afraid, like I was when I wrote this book, like I was when I started doing interviews, like I still get when I do an interview or a radio show or a podcast, or, you know, I still feel that fear, and I still feel that sort of like trepidation. But it's kind of, for me, like, just go forward with it, Serena, because it's what you want to do, and you've got to overcome that. And each time you overcome it, it becomes easier and easier. So that's one way that I've sort of handled the idea of, I don't want to die with my music still in me, so I can't let fear win. I can't let fear take over, and I can't not do what I want to do because I'm afraid. I've got to just go forward with it and embrace
it. This book is a manifestation of that, because you're clearly following your muse by writing what's in you that you feel you want to share with the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, when this book came about, it was out of a big struggle that I was having. I had just left law school. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. The only thing I knew I liked doing was telling stories. And I thought, well, there's no job called storyteller. There's no major called storyteller. I have no idea how I'm going to do what I want to do, which is to just share stories in a way that uplifts people. And I didn't want to tell, fictional stories. I wanted to tell true stories. I wanted to tell inspiring stories. And this book came out of that burning desire to just tell stories, and the book came out of the burning desire to not only just tell stories, but to do it in a way that felt authentic and real for me. And I'm telling you, at first I thought, this is impossible, this is never going to work, why would anybody want to read a bunch of stories about my childhood, nobody knows who I am, nobody cares, that kind of thing. And then it became, the publisher thought, this is a great idea. I started working on a blog, I started getting feedback, like, I love your stories, keep writing. Started getting Facebook followers that said, I read your blog all the time and I love it, please keep writing. It was that sort of thing where I felt like, all right, this is what I feel called to do, and now the universe is giving me green lights, so to speak. Go forward with it. Do it. And the book came out of that. It came out of that entire process of just letting go of the fear and embracing my music and deciding that I wasn't going to die with it in me. And I'm so happy that we wrote this book together. I mean, it's truly something that I'll cherish for the rest of my life, and I'm so, so grateful that I didn't allow fear to take over and not get this done.
Do you see yourself as called to kind of carry the torch forward, do more of this, and kind of bring the message forward as the years go forward?
I see myself as some of that. I see another one of my siblings as some of that. I see... I think that there are people in my family, there are eight of us, and I think that my little sister and myself definitely have the biggest interest in this kind of work. We have the biggest interest in public speaking. We have to do this, and I see her and I both being able to do it in some aspect. And so, yeah, I do feel called in a way, and I think my dad knew that, and I think he felt that. I mean, we had conversations about that, and he would tell me, you know, you're going to do this work in the future. Slow down your talking. You need to speak slower. You know, he would give me this kind of feedback. I feel like he would be laughing right now saying, yes, Serena, slow down.
Well, there's a lot to say. Which sister? Is it Sky?
Sky is a singer. Sky loves to be on stage singing, but no, she does not. She wouldn't want to be a public speaker. Sage. My little sister, Sage, she's in school in New York right now getting her master's at NYU in psychology. She's studying exactly what my dad studied when he was getting his master's.
So, I'm sorry, it's Sage?
Yeah, Sage is the sister that would want to do this.
I said Sky is because I've seen, you know, when I've gone to your father's lectures, and I know that Sky would sing. And I thought that
had
a public persona.
She would love to sing. I mean, she wants to sing, and that's what she does. So she would definitely want to continue singing, but she wouldn't want to publicly speak.
Let's talk about some of the other parts of your book. And just as you go down the chapters, I mean, we touched upon this earlier, to have a mind that's open to everything and attached to nothing. The idea, the notion of lack of attachment is something I have to work on. Let go and flow, as Deepak Chopra says. But how do you how do you get to that place where you can not have that attachment?
I think for me, the idea of, you know, have a mind open to everything and attached to nothing is really meaning don't be attached to the outcome. Be open to ideas, be open to new experiences, be open to new things, but don't be attached to the way you think things ought to go or the way you think people ought to behave or the way you think life is supposed to look. I think it's usually the expectation that comes with being attached to the way things ought to be is what causes the major disappointments in life. So for me, not being attached to anything really means not being attached to the way you think things should be, therefore not having this expectation of, you know, I want you to do this for me. I think you should behave like this, and then I'd be happy. If only my life looked like this, I could do what I want to do with my life. If only people treated me this way, I could move forward with my life. It's like, let go of that. Let go of your attachment to the way things ought to be. Just be open to it. Experience it. Have, you know, that awe that children have, which is why children are, you know, people that live really in the moment. And that's what everybody loves about them. That's the beauty of them, is that they live so fully in the moment because they don't have these sort of expectations and these attachments to the way things should be. They're just, oh, you know, bubbles are coming. Oh, bubbles, yay. Like, they're just so excited in the moment. And I think that's really like a prescription for how to live your life. If you look at children, it's like, model yourself like that. They're just not sitting there, you know, sweating over all these things that may never even happen.
By the way, I guess it must have been rewarding that your dad got to meet your child, his grandchild.
Yeah, it absolutely was. It's funny because the day I gave birth, March 31st, he texted, you know, we had been on the phone, and then it got to a point where I just didn't want to talk to anybody anymore. I was so exhausted, and I had just given birth, and so he was on the phone with my mom, who was in the room, so I was talking to him through speakerphone, but then he texted me and said this long, beautiful message, and he ended it with, "You have tied me to eternity, and for that, I am eternally grateful." And I did not understand what he meant. In fact, it stuck out to me, this line, "You have tied me to eternity." And I even asked him about it later on. What did you mean by "you have tied me to eternity"? Like, it just bothered me in a way because I felt like, do you think that you're going to die? You know, that kind of thing. And he said, well, you know, I just, you know, my genes are carrying on through your child and through you. And it just has such a joyful feeling for me to know that, you know, my legacy continues to live on and will live on and that kind of thing. And I've, you know, and I now I get it. Now I kind of get why he wrote that. And I love that he wrote that. Actually, I printed it out, his image of his text message, and framed it because I love it so much that he wrote that to me.
We're talking with Serena Dyer. Don't Die With Your Music Still In You is a Hay House book. One of the other chapters is, and I love this one, give up your personal history. Live in the present, basically, right? Don't get caught up in what used to be.
Exactly. He and I had a long conversation about this particular chapter when we were on a cruise ship in 2012, and he was basically saying, when we were on this large cruise ship and we were in the Mediterranean and we would do this walk around the edge of the boat, you know, the like there's like a pathway around the whole boat, and we would do this walk to get exercise each day. And when we would get to the back of the boat, he would say, now just look at the wake of the boat. It's the trail we leave behind. And I want you to just stand here and look for a minute and contemplate this, the trail we leave behind. And I would do that. I would, you know, think, okay, this is the wake. This is the trail we leave behind. Got it. And he would say, is the wake pushing the boat forward? And I would say, well, no, the wake isn't pushing the boat forward. The wake is the trail that left behind. He said, exactly. It's the same thing with our personal history. Our personal history is not what pushes us forward. Our personal history is what we leave behind. Never get caught up in your past. Never get caught up in your personal history, because it's just the trail we leave behind. It's not what drives us in the present moment. It's not what moves us forward. And if we think that it is, then we're really still in the past.
The next chapter, which is a wonderful thing to remember, and I think you quote Albert Einstein, as you can't solve a problem with the same mind that created it. Einstein said, the world as we have created it is a process of our thinking. It cannot be changed without changing our thinking. And I love the phrase your father would say, change the way you look at things, and the things you look at change.
Right, exactly. And this whole idea is that the way you think created the problem that you're currently in. So if you don't like, or maybe not even the problem, it created the situation that you're currently in. Uh-huh. If you don't like the situation that you're currently in, you have to change the way you think. And it's that simple. And for so many of us, it's that hard. It's like, I can't change the way I think. I've lived my whole life thinking this way. I've behaved this way my whole life. You know, I can't change who I am. And actually, that was one of my dad's favorite things that he used to say, which was when he was in Austria having lunch with Viktor Frankl after they had done a meeting together. Viktor Frankl said that the thing he realized most when he was in the concentration camp was that you had to change the way you looked at something in order to find beauty in the situation you were in. And he said the people that were in the concentration camp with him, that my dad repeated this story numerous times, the people that were in the concentration camp with him, if they couldn't find beauty, if they couldn't find meaning in a bowl of dirty water with a floating fish head in it that they were given for dinner, then they would usually perish pretty quickly upon arrival in a concentration camp. But the people that could remember love, the people that could find meaning, the people that could still find beauty, they had to literally change what their definition of beauty was in order to adapt. And the people that could do that were the people that survived. And that's where that whole idea came from my dad, that if you change the way you look at the things you look at change. It came from his conversation with Viktor Frankl, I think it was in 1979, in Vienna, Austria. And you know, I think that it's the most true, impactful statement. In fact, the day before my dad died, we were on the phone, and he said to me, I really, really want you to read Man's Search for Meaning again. If you haven't read it, go back and read it again. And I said, well, Dad, I've read it twice now. He said, read it for a third time. He said, I just finished it for maybe his 10th time on his way back from Australia. And he said, there's so much in that book. You could read it 20 times and you'll get something new. So what do you know? I'm reading it for the third time.
You know, you remind me of the movie Life is Beautiful. I don't know if you ever saw that movie.
I did see that movie, and he loved that movie.
I mean, that's exactly what you were talking about, in a concentration camp, and the outcome changes as a result of the mindset of the protagonist in the movie. It's an incredible film.
Right, exactly. And the other thing he talked about was the idea of hope, that people that gave up hope, you know, the people that would say, Viktor Frankl had told him that people in the concentration camp that would say, you know, March 20th is the day we're going to get liberated. I know it. And then I saw a sign, and then somebody else said March 20th. And then it my, you know, my friend that's in here, it's his daughter's birthday. So we all know it's March 20th. And March 20th would come and go, and all of those people would die that had put so much faith in this idea that it was March 20th. When that day came and nothing happened, they lost all hope. And Viktor Frankl observed that, and he wrote about that. And you know, there's so many things like this, these experiences that my dad had that were like, you know, really pivotal moments for him in his life that changed the way that he thought about things, that impacted him in such a way that they changed the way he was thinking, and therefore, you know, the way he was thinking changed. He's had so many experiences like that, and he wrote about them, actually, and I Can See Clearly Now, which is why it's my favorite book of his.
That also talks about attachment. You're attached to March 20th, March 20th, March 20th, and March 20th comes, and what you're attached to doesn't transpire, and you've got to give up that attachment, which is murderous for people if they are so attached they just can't let go.
Well, exactly, and that's the whole idea of the expectation. It's like if you have so much attachment to something, you have an expectation, and when that doesn't happen, it can destroy you. And I think, you know, in a more simple sense, you see that in relationships all the time. Even, you know, I love you if I want you, I'll be with you if you behave like this. I'm attached to the way you behave. I'm attached to what you can do for me, and I have an expectation of that. I'm holding on to that expectation, and therefore, when you don't behave the way I want you to, I'm disappointed, I'm hurt, I want to give up, I want to go, rather than say, I love you for who you are. You know, I don't care about what you can do for me. I love you for who you are, even if that means you don't do the things that I want you to do. It's a totally different way of approaching relationships, life, you know, any situation that you're in.
And that leads to resentment, and then you have a chapter, There Are No Justified Resentments. So resentment is never a viable option, correct?
Correct, because resentment is something that happens to you. So if you are resentful, then you are the one carrying around the thoughts of you know, dislike, the thoughts of anger, the thoughts of hatred, the thoughts of rage, and all that does is weaken you. And there's no justified situation in which you're weakening yourself, aligning yourself with those kinds of negative emotions. I think that the idea that there are no justified resentments doesn't mean that you don't have a right to be mad because somebody did something to you. Okay, go there, be mad, process it, and let it go. Because by you carrying on that resentment, it's like there's a famous line that says, revenge is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. I mean, that's exactly what resentment is. That's exactly what revenge-seeking behavior is. It's like, I'm so mad at you, so I'm going to carry around this hatred inside of me. It does nothing to you. You know, if I hate you, it doesn't impact you. It does nothing for you. It affects me every day, though, and there's just no justification in doing that.
We're talking with Serena Dyer, and you quote, in your book, Don't Die With Your Music Still In You, I remember talking to your dad about when he was reading the Neville Goddard's book about manifestation and before you go to bed at night, kind of imagining the way things you'd like to be, the way you'd like things to be. And he said, well, the secret had it almost right, but not exactly right, because you have to assume the feeling of what it is you'd like to create. And you quote Neville Goddard here, who says, health, wealth, beauty, genius, not created. They're only manifested by the arrangement of your mind, that is, by your concept of yourself, and your concept of yourself is all that you accept and consent to as true. And from there, you can manifest, at least that's a starting point, I would think, to manifest what you would like to have happen in your life.
Exactly, because one of the things that my dad used to say to me all the time is, you know, the secret, in a way, got it wrong in the sense that you don't get in life what you want. You get in life what you are. And the idea behind that is that, you know, everything is energy, and that's what the whole idea of The Secret was about, is, you know, we vibrate on frequencies and laws of attraction and that kind of thing. But you can't just sit in a place and say, I want, I want, I want, and expect it to show up, because you're coming from a place of lack. So I want indicates that it's not already there. Whereas what Neville was talking about and what my dad went on to talk about and we wrote about was the idea of assuming the feeling of the wish fulfilled. Meaning, assume in your body how it would feel if what you wanted was there, therefore bringing the energy into your body, therefore becoming it. So it's like, instead of saying, I want to be wealthy, I want money, it's saying, I live in such a way that I already know what it feels like to be wealthy. In fact, when I go to bed at night, I feel in my body, okay, what would it feel like if my bank account had some extra zeros at the end of it? What would it feel like if I had financial independence, if I could pay off my debt? What would that feel like? And you assume into your body how that would feel. And everybody can do that. I mean, we all have an imagination. And Einstein actually said, imagination is everything. It is the preview of life's coming attraction. I mean, if he's the guy that first wrote about and talked about and knew about laws of attraction, and he's saying that your imagination is the preview of life's coming attraction, then you better believe that using your imagination to assume the feeling of what you want to happen rather than what you don't want to happen, rather than what you're afraid of happening, that's going to be the thing that gets you where you want to be. And that's what Neville was talking about. That's what my dad was talking about. It's like, assume into your body the feeling of what it is that you want to happen happening. And for me, it's exactly how this book came about, because the place that I was at was, I don't know how this is going to work. Nobody's going to want to read this. I don't feel good about myself. And instead, I started to go to bed at night and think, all right now I go to bed and I have anxiety, I have fear, I have doubt. How would it feel if just for a moment, I could feel peace? I could feel a sense of pride. I could feel a sense of accomplishment. I could feel content. How would that feel? And I would be able to get that feeling by just imagining it for like a moment. And then it became a habit of mine, and it became a few more moments, and it became a few minutes, and it became, you know, I could get it for like 30 minutes. And it became a thing where I began to not only feel what it was that I wanted to show up in my life, I began to see things happening that aligned me with what it was that I wanted to show up. It was actually starting to happen. So it was like, you know, like I said, I started a blog and I got positive feedback. I did a Facebook post and people would comment on them, or I would get an interest from somebody that wanted to do an interview, and I would get this positive feedback. And the result was that I was kind of becoming even more aligned with what it was that I was seeking without even really knowing it. And it was all by assuming the feeling of the wish fulfilled. So I went from a point of just having to assume it to actually living it to, you know, to it became my life. And I everything changed by just using that one practice alone, assuming the feeling. And I changed. It wasn't like I stayed the same and just was assuming a feeling at night. It was like I stopped doing things that were bad habits that kept me from being the person I wanted to be. You know, it was like things just change when you bring into your body the awareness and the energy of who it is you want to be and what it is you want to have show up. You can't just want it. You have to become it.
You know, that's another, you reminded me of another great book of your dad's Wishes Fulfilled. And the idea of doing this, by the way, before you go to bed at night, as he would say, it would marinate. So you're in bed for 6, 7, 8 hours. That's the best time to do it because you're kind of feeding your subconscious mind when you do it that way.
Yeah, exactly. And I've had that since he passed away, actually. I've had where, you know, I get in bed at night and I'm quiet and all of a sudden I feel sort of paralyzed with anxiety or sadness. Like, you know, in those quiet moments is when it comes. And I've really had to learn to take those last few minutes before I go to bed at night and release that and instead start thinking about all of the love that I have for my dad, all of the funny stories that we share, all of the good memories, the good experiences. Not that I don't allow myself to have those sad moments. I do, but I don't want to go to bed in that space. I want to go to bed in the space of love, in the space of friendship, in the space of understanding, in the space of laughter. And I choose to do that. Every time that happens to me when I, you know, start to get panicked that he died, I just make an effort to, you know, choose a different thought, change the way I'm looking at it. And the result is that I've had so many unbelievable dreams with him in them since I started doing that.
Let's talk about the words I am. I noticed that when we communicate, you'll end with I am Serena. You write about the words I am, the I am discourses, for example, Saint Germain. What does that mean?
The I am discourses and the whole teaching of Saint Germain is the idea that the words I am are the two most powerful words in the universe. They are the name of God. In other words, saying I am is declaring yourself as something, as whatever it is that follows. So if you say, I am strong, you are reconfirming that you are strong. If you say, I am weak, you are putting out into the universe that which you don't want, which is more weakness. It's something that Jesus said over and over in the Bible. Let the weak man say, I am strong. When Moses asked the burning bush, what is your name? I am that I am. And the idea is that the words I am are so powerful because we're, you know, words are energy, our thoughts are energy, our bodies are energy, everything is energy. Surely when we die, as, you know, I've just experienced, we do not just cease to exist. The energy that we are goes on, even though we shed this body and leave it behind. So the idea is that the words I am, there's an energy to them. And whatever you say after that is what you are reconfirming out to the universe that you want to continue showing up in your life. So I've made a habit of saying I am followed by whatever it is that I want to be, that I want more of, that I, you know, want to be more like. So I am a being of light. I am love. I am a good friend. I'm a good mother. I am patient. You know, these aren't things that I always feel like I am, but these are things I want to reconfirm to myself that I am, that I can be, that I'm a part of. And for me, those words, I am, it's like calling into existence that which doesn't yet exist. And I think that they're very, very powerful words.
Your book really is got so much in it that is representative of your dad and also obviously of what you have learned and come to believe. And it's in your voice, which is a great one. Don't die with your music still in you. Serena, I feel very privileged to have known your dad and to talk to you about him. So thank you very much for talking to us here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it so much. This is Heal Planet, and I'm Alan Combs.